Well, some experts say one big reason for the decreasing teen birth rate is due to mandatory sex education in schools. Good afternoon. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network. California isn't alone in seeing a drop in births to teen moms. Other states, particularly those that, like California, have comprehensive sex ed as part of their school's curriculum, are also seeing a decrease. The teen birth rate remains stubbornly higher in some states, however. This hour, we'll talk about the relationship between sex education in schools, the availability of contraception and information about contraception to teens, and the teen birth rate. I have a pair of guests joining me today on the Kathleen Dunn program. First, let's introduce Elizabeth Schroeder, Executive Director of ANSWER and an internationally recognized expert in the field of sexuality education and youth development. Elizabeth Schroeder, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn program.
Thanks, John.
Also joining me this afternoon in our conversation is David P. Gushy, Distinguished University Professor of Christian Ethics and Director of the Center for Theology and Public Life at Mercer University. Professor, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
So let's talk about this California study. Elizabeth, 60% decrease in teen pregnancies, pretty significant. What are they doing in California to achieve this kind of result?
Well, it's wonderful, and actually what's going on in California really just reinforces what we've known for decades, which is age and developmentally appropriate comprehensive sexuality education that's taught by trained educators, helps young people to delay sexual behaviors, and it helps them use safer sex methods much more consistently and effectively. So basically what we're seeing in California is just another example of proof of that.
And we're hearing the term comprehensive sex education. Describe what that means.
Well, comprehensive sexuality education is education that's far beyond abstinence. So we do have a lot of proponents who really push to teach abstinence only until marriage. And any comprehensive sexuality education program is going to include abstinence as a very important key component, but then goes on to many other topics. The National Sexuality Education Standards, which were just released in 2012 by the Future of Sex Ed Initiative, talks about how it's important to teach anatomy and physiology and puberty and adolescent development, pregnancy and reproduction, identity, and many other topics that are key to overall holistic development of a human being.
And Professor Gushy, what's your take on what's going on in California? And nationally, we have seen a drop in teen birth rates in most of the states in the United States. Not all, still some areas where there are problems, but we are seeing a decreasing teen birth rate. What do you attribute this to?
Well, first of all, it's great news. Teen pregnancy is bad for everyone, bad for the teenagers, and bad usually for the child that is either born into tough circumstances or aborted. I'm confident that comprehensive sex education is playing a constructive role. I imagine there are other factors as well. But, as a Christian ethicist, I think such a dramatic drop in the teen pregnancy rate is really great news.
Could we be seeing some changes in our culture in general that might be behind this as well? Obviously, it's really difficult to identify one thing and say this is it. This is the one thing that's causing this. But I guess I was curious as I was reading the article. Are we thinking differently about sex as a culture these days? And Professor, we'll go to you first, and then Elizabeth.
I spend a lot of time around young people, college students, seminary students, high school students. My kids are just have come through that stage. I think there's a lot less casualness, especially about the significance of having sex, risking pregnancy. Everybody knows people whose lives have been ruined by premature sexual activity and unwanted pregnancy. So I think that maybe the attitudes of the young themselves are changing, and maybe some greater realism that with the delay in when people are getting married and even the decline of marriage as an institution, we have to be more realistic in what we teach about sex for that long stretch of time between puberty and when people may or may not eventually get married.
Elizabeth Schroeder, what about it? Are teens having less sex these days due to some changes in attitudes, or are they just being more careful about it, do you think?
Well, I think that there's been a real shift, not just in attitudes about sexuality, but attitudes about sexuality education. In California, what we have, and I'll just give a couple of examples because ANSWER does work with a good number of organizations and entities there, you have two wonderful, huge unified school districts in Los Angeles and San Francisco with amazing staff working for them. You have great community-based organizations, some of which specialize in sexual health, some of which specialize in the specific populations that are represented in California. So really, to use David's word of realism, that's what they're looking at. We finally have adults who are not looking at what should be. They're looking at what is. And the reality is that young people are curious about sexuality. Young people are engaging in shared sexual behaviors. So if we want to be effective in keeping them safe and healthy, we have to accept that reality and then teach to them recognizing that reality, because it's a youth value. So that's what we really have to talk with them about. We also have many more parents who truly want what's best for their children and who may not be comfortable with it, but realize that sexual behavior and sexual experimentation is a part of being a young person. So what we have in California, as we've seen in many other states, is adults are working together much more effectively. Parents are and should be the primary sexuality educators of their children, but it's unrealistic to expect that they'll know everything. They have to work in collaboration, in partnership with schools, with sexuality experts, with community-based organizations, with faith-based organizations. And so when we see adults working together, when they listen to the research, when they listen to the decades of proof and experience, then we see a positive impact like what we're seeing here.
Professor Gushy, you know, it's always kind of awkward for children to think about the fact that their parents may have had sex at least once. and it's just as awkward for...
Right.
Yeah, and it's just as awkward. Well, they're more likely to believe in the virgin birth, I think, but it's just as likely. I mean, you know, parents are just as awkward about the idea that their children may be engaging in sex. And in particular, those homes which self-identify as Christian, where the values are that you don't have sex until marriage. When we talk about the reality of what's going on, how do you have where can we have that constructive conversation where we admit the reality of what's going on and try and get that to mesh somehow with a belief system that insists otherwise in some cases?
You are right that these conversations are often very awkward between parents and children, or even impossible. Sometimes even if parents want to have good, honest conversations, the children are, they run screaming from the room because it's just so awkward to talk to your mom and dad about that. I think that Elizabeth is right that we do need multiple voices speaking into the lives of young people, hoping that at least one or two of these voices can be heard by teenagers and young people, whether it's faith-based organizations or educators at school or, you know, somebody along the way can be heard. I think that the problem that has held back comprehensive sex education for conservative Christian families is precisely that we have believed for generations, for longer than generations, that sex belongs in marriage. And it's been hard for people to wrap their minds around, how do you hold faithful to those values? How do you teach those values to your children while still finding a way to get them the information that they need in case they do not adhere to that value? And I think that that helps to explain why there has been such profound resistance to comprehensive sex education, especially in the South. I think even that is changing because of, you know, growing realism about where we are in culture and a desire to not leave our children exposed to disease and pregnancy and heartbreak and other kinds of problems that can emerge if we're not realistic in this area.
Well, I'm looking at a map of the United States, and in terms of what the birth rate, the teen birth rate has been. These are percentage of change in birth rates for all teenagers aged 15 to 19. It's broken down by state. And it is, we can't just broad brush and say, well, the South still has a problem. Some states in the South still have a problem. Florida seems to be doing particularly well. I don't know what's going on down there. But there are some states which are still struggling. Not all of them are in the South. In those areas where we are seeing problems, places like Oklahoma and Arkansas, Louisiana, Nebraska, even Indiana, Kentucky, even Michigan, are there some things that we can identify, Elizabeth Schroeder, that are characteristic of those areas where we're not seeing the kind of success that other parts of the country are seeing?
Absolutely, and let me just preface this by saying also we have to keep in mind that sexuality education is about far more than pregnancy and STD prevention. So even though a lot of the focus here, and certainly this report from California, had to do with the teen pregnancy, teen birth rates, we have to keep in mind that sexuality is such a broader topic. And so there are a lot of areas that impact how young people make decisions about whether or not to engage in sexual behaviors. So it's really important, especially when we talk about educating younger people, to keep that in mind, because this is when, you know, the folks like David was saying who oppose the work that we do, who tend to be a bit more the conservative end, they have this thought that when we talk about teaching younger kids about sexuality, that we're teaching about very advanced topics, and we are absolutely not. We're teaching the foundational knowledge that then you build on, and it gets more advanced as young people grow older. Now, in terms of your question about what's going on in states where it's being more, seeing more positive outcome, and what's, what about the states where we don't? There are many factors that are going on. One big factor has to do with what is the state mandate that has to do with sexuality education. Not every state in the United States has a mandate or a law requiring some kind of sexuality education. And so in the states where we are seeing challenges, and it's not universal, they tend to be the states with the greatest challenges that either have no sex ed mandate or they have the mandate that they have is negative. So it will have exclusionary language. It will be very negative about lesbian and gay young people. It will be abstinence only until marriage. So those are the kinds of things that we tend to see. That's one factor. The second really has to do with the coordination of services and the coordination of adults working together that I mentioned before, that California and some other states are doing extremely well. And it really has to do with the squeaky wheel. So if you have folks who's yelling the loudest, and you have folks who oppose the work that's being done by comprehensive sexuality education proponents, even though there is just gads of research supporting the effectiveness of that approach, but then people get caught up in what David was saying, which is this sort of faux moralism of, but it's wrong, but it's wrong. It's not. I actually believe very strongly that it's not moral. It is immoral to keep information from young people.
Professor?
I respect the concerns of parents who are worried that somehow the message that they would be getting in the public place like a school would be different from what they're getting at home, but I think that as a matter of public health and as a matter of even love for young people and concern for their well-being, they need the information that, and they need moral formation as well as all kinds of information to help them make wise choices with their sexuality. And I think that increasingly evangelical Christians like myself are coming to understand that, and also to understand that there are a number of places in which the values that we hold to related to sexuality can be communicated that would be more kind of richly religious or richly moral according to our own terms, but that we should not seek to impose that vision necessarily in the public arena such as public schools. It's a matter of public health and the matter of the common good. And so I'm hoping that attitudes are beginning to change on this, especially as, you know, we pay attention to what's really going on, both on the negative side and on the positive side.
I'm John Munson. You're listening to the Kathleen Dunn Program on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about some new statistics. The teen birth rate continues to go down. It remains stubbornly higher in some areas. A 60% decrease, though, in California, which is what caught our eye last week when we were casting about for topics for the program this week. And so we're talking about that. A pair of guests joining me, and you can join as well at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Maybe you had sex ed in school. What age did you have it, and how effective do you think it was? We haven't specifically talked about Wisconsin. We've talked about California, and we've talked about the rest of the country and kind of outlined this. Wisconsin is one of the states that had a decline of between 20 and 29%, according to the most recent statistics. So that's headed in the right direction. But if you had sex ed in school, you know, what age did you have it? If you didn't, would it have made a difference for you in your life? What's your story? 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. You can also reach us via email. The address is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. And you can find the Kathleen Dunn Program on Facebook. And leave your comment or question there. My guests are Elizabeth Schroeder, Executive Director of ANSWER and an internationally recognized expert in the field of sexuality education and youth development, and David P. Gushy, Distinguished University Professor, Christian Ethics, and Director of the Center for Theology and Public Life at Mercer University. You can join us as well at 800-486-8655. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn this week. This hour, we're talking about teen pregnancy. It's going down across the country. Most states reporting decreases of 20% or more. Some states not doing quite so well. Other states doing fantastic. California, 60% decrease between 2007 and 2011. And we're exploring some of the reasons behind this encouraging piece of statistical news with a couple of guests and with you, if you choose to join us at 800-486-8655. Elizabeth Schroeder is Executive Director of ANSWER and an internationally recognized expert in the field of sexuality education and youth development. And David Gushy is Distinguished University Professor of Christian Ethics and Director for the Center for Theology and Public Life at Mercer University. We have a caller on the line from Madison, so let's take that call. Alan, good afternoon, and thanks for being part of the program today.
No, thank you for the opportunity.
Go ahead.
Sure. Well, I am 32. I had sex ed in middle school. But honestly, it was mostly a lot of kids giggling. I didn't feel I actually learned anything at all other than condoms existed. My parents were the ones who helped me a lot with it. Now, I don't think abstinence education actually works, but abstinence was what was explained to me was the only way you could actually be sure. That didn't mean that they didn't explain to me what condoms were and everything else, but... like I said, I'm not sure how much I actually got out of school sex ed education.
Mm-hmm. And what was the conversation like with your parents, if you don't mind me asking?
Very awkward. it was between my father and I, and he basically explained that, you know, the man goes into the woman when you love her. And, you know, it was very crouched in very, very common terms. I think the biggest thing I got a sex education was the fact that I found out that women's bodies were not the same under the hood, which was something obviously I did not know up to that point. That's probably the only thing I got out of it. With my parents specifically, it was explained that, you know, this is a big commitment, that it's you should only do it with somebody you love. They definitely crouched it in terms of marriage.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you. Professor Gushy, would you like to comment on what Alan had to say and then Elizabeth?
Well, I mean, that Alan's story reminds us that it's quite possible for anybody to find it a very awkward conversation, even trained educators. Of course, we don't know exactly who was offering the sexuality education at his school or what their training was or whatever. And I do think that values need to be communicated. I often press in these conversations, especially with people in the sexuality education community, what kind of values are on the table for discussion? Values about, for example, the intrinsic vulnerability of being sexually involved with somebody. The role that marriage has historically played and why it has been lifted up as the best context for sex and so on. So it's really difficult to talk about values in a morally pluralistic environment, but it is one thing that I think needs to be paid attention to in any kind of adequate discussion of sexuality with young people.
Elizabeth Schroeder?
Well, I think, Alan, that was such a great story, and he's certainly not alone in that experience, and in fact, that exact experience that we've heard many, many times here at Answer. And it, to me, it's the biggest rationale for why we need to start earlier with children. We need to start as parents. You know, we are both parents, David and I. We need to start earlier. We need to start talking with our kids about it. Again, I love this idea of being in a pluralistic society. So if the value in a family is you wait to have sex until you're married, then you have the accompanying lesson of not everyone who is in a sexual relationship is heterosexual, and not everybody can get married. I mean, there are many, many lessons that come with whatever value a family is communicating. And that's really a huge responsibility for parents and caregivers to do. So that's a real big important point, is to start early and to keep talking about it. Many parents make the mistake of waiting until their children ask them the questions, and a lot of kids won't. So it's really our job as parents is to step up and say, I'm going to bring this up. And yes, they may go running, screaming from the room, and we have to have that strong parent ego to say, okay, I'm going to try this again and keep going with it. The other issue that Alan brings up, and I think David was saying, was it has to do really the training of the teacher or the educator, because we do have some great community-based and state-based educators that do work in school districts and at community-based organizations. What we have found, and this really has contributed very much to the success of comprehensive sexuality education, is pre-service teacher training, meaning what is the training that folks who are going to be school teachers, what are they getting on sexuality education? And back in 1996, when there was a survey done, there were zero universities and colleges that required pre-service teachers to know anything about sexuality. That's starting to change. So we're seeing a lot of progress that more and more pre-service teacher training institutions are requiring not just human sexuality content, but also methodology courses on how do you teach about this very unique, very nuanced, very sensitive topic in ways that get young people to remember a little bit more than Alan did, and hopefully a whole lot more, whether it's at middle school, high school, elementary school, college. This is another thing that the Future of Sex Ed Initiative is working on, the same folks who did the National Sex Ed Standards back in 2012. And so we're hoping to really work on that infrastructure and get folks right from the moment they're getting into the classroom to really know what are the best practices and what's the most effective and most age and developmentally appropriate content and skills to teach young people.
I'm going to put out another call to our listeners, perhaps, and based on Alan's comment, kind of a follow-up to that, and parents, how are you approaching this? Those of you who have children of age where you might be discussing this, what's your plan? What are you thinking about? How much fear are you approaching this with? And for those of you who are maybe empty nesters, how did you handle this? How did you manage it when your own children were going through those turbulent junior high years? And did you just keep your fingers crossed and hope for the best? Were you able to have that conversation? How did it turn out? 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Let's take another call. Alan, by the way, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. We have Guy on line two, and he's got a story as well. Guy, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. How's it going? I also wanted to point out that it's not just state by state. I went to elementary and middle school outside of Chicago, very well-to-do, well-trained teachers, and they not only gave you the mechanics, they gave you the consequences that could happen. Then for a short while, I moved to a rural area in Illinois, and basically it was, here's how it's done, and don't do it unless you're married. So a lot of the problem and a lot of the difficulties they're having are leaving it up to the local school boards. It's all across the board. There's no consistency for anything.
Mm-hmm. Guy, thanks. Thanks for sharing that perspective. Elizabeth, is that one of the issues here? We really don't have a nationwide policy on this. I mean, traditionally, school policies and curricula have been largely left up to local school boards. That's not necessarily true everywhere, but that has been a tradition in the United States. Is that one of the things that kind of works against us here a little
bit? Absolutely. I mean, it can work for us and it can work against us because there is so much local control. You can be in a state where there is a very restrictive mandate, and folks in select communities will still have some kind of dialogue work within the state because, of course, they want to be in compliance with the mandate, but they're able to do it in a way that avoids the shame and the fear-based programming that we see in far too many abstinence-only-until-marriage states. So, you know, it's something that folks really need to be invested in this and understand that this is important to teach about and address. But certainly, you can also have states. I actually live in New Jersey, which has one of the strongest sexuality education mandates in the United States, and there are some schools where they're doing an absolutely outstanding job and other schools where they're not doing it at all. The biggest challenge with the mandates and the laws around the U.S. is two things. There are two challenges. One is there's no accountability. There's no accountability measure. So if you are teaching sexuality education, you're in compliance with the law, great, that's wonderful. But nobody's going to swoop in like that movie Minority Report and say, oh, you didn't teach sexuality education. And that's a big challenge because we want people to know when they're doing a really great job, and we need folks to know when they're not doing a great job or when they need to be doing something better or doing it at all. The second issue is that even though there have been changes, we still have the ripple effect of the No Child Left Untested. Human sexuality tends to come under the health aspect of the curriculum. Health is not a tested subject. So as a result, it's not seen as high on the food chain in the curriculum in a school environment. So when a school is very strapped for money, they're looking to cut something. They tend to cut something related to health, which includes human sexuality or the arts, as we've been seeing.
Mm-hmm. Professor Geshe, what about, do you think that we need to have more of a national conversation about this topic? Does it rise to that level of importance? And do we, what about the idea that, this isn't tested on, so we aren't going to spend money on it?
I think this is a nationally significant issue because of what is at stake, because of the well-being of children, the well-being of young people. And the issue of abortion, which we end up fighting about relentlessly politically, in which I've long argued the best way to deal with that problem is to reduce the number of unwanted pregnancies. I would also say that having lived in a small southern town, I'm not in such a town now, but having done so for over a decade, in the town that our caller, you might sound like the kind of town that our caller comes from, the local public school is in many cases just an extension of the majority values of the church going public or of the local community, and a lot of times the loudest, most fearful voice wins. So you might have some parents who would be more open and some school board members who would be more open to a more comprehensive approach, but then they get shouted down or intimidated by those who are just convinced that talking more comprehensively will lead their children into temptation. And so I'm not surprised to hear that rural experience was far less satisfying educationally than the urban experience. I try to say as a Christian to other Christians that we do have separation of church and state in this country, and that you do have churches in which you can communicate exactly whatever vision, and homes, which you can communicate exactly whatever vision of sexuality you want to communicate, but that the local public school is not either the church or the home, and one's values do not need to be imposed there. There needs to be an environment that is far more broad and reflects the pluralistic values of the actual, of the nation that we live in.
I guess I'm just visiting with the two of you this hour, and it begs the question, how do we advance the conversation past that kind of political tripwire and past the ideology that so often gets in our way? I'm not going to say theology, because it seems to me that it's more about ideology than anything else. But how do we get past that to have a civil conversation about a terribly significant, if just looking at the numbers, a terribly significant social issue? How can we get past that tripwire without making things blow up on us? And David, we'll go to you first, and then Elizabeth.
I think that it helps to understand that there are millions of Americans. I don't think it's the majority. It's a fading number, but it's still a lot, millions, who experience the broader culture as a culture increasingly alien to their values and increasingly alien to the values that they believe that their faith has taught them. And so they're in a posture of often of aggrievement, of bewilderment, and of anger related to the values that they feel like are being communicated in the broader culture. And so when people feel bewildered, angry, and aggrieved, they're rarely thinking realistically or rationally. They're mainly thinking out of their emotions. I try to help people in my world understand that the culture is not the church, and the culture is changing, but that there are things to be learned from a changing culture, sometimes very positive things to be learned, and also that the world that their faith, our faith, teaches us to want to live in is not always the world that we actually live in. Like, I'd like to live in a world where there were no abortions, but like there are. And so to realistically figure out why and to deal with that one realistic reason at a time involves, you might say, moving out of the world, the kind of the dreamy world that we would like to live in, into the world that we actually live in, and dealing with it realistically, kind of one issue at a time, one problem at a time, trying to bring our values to bear, but doing so within the context of real data, real best practices, real world realities. And I think people get that. And when you say that that is the way to actually care for young people and help address some of these profound social problems, then maybe people can be brought along.
Elizabeth Schroeder?
Well, you know, there is such a great diversity in the United States, and diversity can be defined in so many different ways. And just going, you know, with what David was talking about in terms of religion, there are so many different faith communities. There are lots of different... There's a lot of diversity within Christianity, and there are many non-Christian faiths out there. And there are a lot of folks who don't even belong to a formal faith community. So coming even from that standpoint, all a person can do is really address sexuality within the context of their own values and beliefs. The challenge that we have and that we find, and I agree with what he was saying about school-based sexuality education, and that religion does not belong in a school, is that you just have to look at the actual content. You have to look at the skills young people need. This is where the partnership between parents and faith communities and young people and schools come together. The school isn't the place to discuss religion. What they should be talking about religion and faith and values at home, which is really, really important. But that's, you know, a parent who comes in and says, I don't think that my child should be having sexuality education, that is the parent's right. But when parents come in and say, I don't think any children should be having sexuality education, that's foisting their beliefs on other people. That's what's at the root, John, I think, of our not making greater progress in this topic. Extremism is our biggest enemy in any kind of social change. It doesn't matter if you're talking about the extreme right, the extreme left. And there have been many, many occasions within the comprehensive sexuality education movement where we have tried to come together with folks who really espouse the abstinence only until marriage viewpoint and saying, you know what, there has to be some stuff on which we agree. We all agree that we want young people to grow up happy and healthy. Okay, we agree on that. We all agree that it is best to wait until ideal, and we couldn't agree on what an age or what, you know, what the idea is, but it's best to wait until a young person is ready to engage in a sexual relationship. That disagreement on what readiness means, for some it was adulthood and marriage. For other people it was, do you know about safer sex and, you know, the sometimes negative consequences of shared sexual behaviors. But if we couldn't get past that point, which is what happens a lot of the time, then we can't go forward with this dialogue. And I have to say, I have seen, I've been in this field for over 20 years, and I have seen so much resistance to even having that dialogue. And I bet, you know, David has probably written on this extensively, but when you are from a very fundamentalist, very conservative background, the whole point is not to question your viewpoint. And what we're trying to do is question and say, what is the best approach? Here's what the research is saying. So why aren't we using this best approach with young people when all of the research is saying this is the way to do it most effectively? That's when the extremism, that's when the uber conservative morals get in the way. You know, use that in your own family, but we're talking about teaching young people, keeping them happy, safe, healthy, and sometimes saving lives. So there's no room for this extremism. We have to find the common ground, but there has to be a willingness on both sides here to find that common ground.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion, and we'll be joined by a mother who's going to tell us how she educated her own daughter. So stay tuned for that. I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Kathleen Dunn Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, well, we started talking about a recent study which points to a pretty significant decrease in teen pregnancy. 60% in California, 20 to 30%, even 40% in some other states, less in some states. We're talking about the reasons for that, the ongoing discussion about sexuality among teens and comprehensive sex ed, the availability of contraception, and a whole lot of other topics. I've got a pair of guests joining me this hour. Elizabeth Schroeder is Executive Director of ANSWER, an internationally recognized expert in the field of sexuality education and youth development, and David Gushy, Distinguished University Professor of Christian Ethics and Director of the Center for Theology and Public Life at Mercer University. Thanks to both of them for taking time out of what I know must be busy schedules to talk about this topic with our listeners today. And speaking of our listeners, you could join the discussion at 800-486-8655. If you're a parent, how did you approach this topic with your children? If you're somebody who went through sex ed in school, as we had an earlier listener tell of his experience, what was your experience like and how did it affect you? Let's hear next from Kathy in Madison. Kathy, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. I feel very, very strongly about parents educating their children, but oftentimes parents don't have that information. I was a family living educator, and I knew what the research said about how important it really was for parents to tell their children how they felt about sexual activity of their teenagers, as well as knowing how to give them the correct information. So my daughter probably was 12, and I sat down with her and I said, this is how I feel, and this is what our faith tells us about no sexual activity. And I said, I don't want you as an adolescent or a teenager to have sex. It's just not a good place to go, nor your friends. But aside from that, I want you to know what the facts are about your body, fellow's body. And so I gave her the physiology as best as I knew it about their body and activities and birth control, etc., because I said to her, I want you to know the truth, and if any of your friends come to you with misinformation, I want you to correct them. And they did. She would get questions from her friends because they somehow perceived that she knew stuff they didn't know.
And Kathy, if you don't mind my asking, how did your daughter take this? How did she respond to that conversation?
She was receptive to it. And she would come and tell me about her friends that were sexually active, and which I thought was, wow, she trusts me with this information.
Mm-hmm.
She was not active sexually as an adolescent nor in college. That much I do know. She's now a nurse.
Okay. Kathy, thanks so much for your call. Professor Gashi, I'd like you to get your take on what Kathy had to say, and then Elizabeth Schroeder.
Kathy sounds like a great mom. Very honest with her daughter, communicated values, communicated the reasons for those values, and communicated the best information she had. That sounds like just a great approach.
Mm-hmm. Elizabeth Schroeder?
Oh, I agree. I think she did a terrific job. She was very clear. She shared the facts. There's a wonderful colleague of ours who has worked in comprehensive sexuality education named Pam Wilson, and she's talked for years about the words and the music, which is just like in a song, sometimes you listen to what's said and sometimes you listen to how it's being said. In talking with your kids about sexuality and especially and other topics that are really important like that, a lot of times young people want to hear the music, so how you're expressing it. And so what Kathy did that was so good was she said, I'm going to do this. And so she really communicated in how she spoke that this was an important topic, this is what our values, our family values are, and here are the facts. And this is why I'm telling this to you. And that's very, very important to young people. We as parents have to get away from this idea that we have to have the talk with our kids. So it's one talk and then you're done. We have to think about this as the talks. And we have to start very early. We have to keep reinforcing and building on the information. And you know what? We're not going to know all of it. And that's why we have to go to sexuality experts and to our faith leaders if we're a member of a faith community, or to educators and child development specialists and say, is this age appropriate? Can my child really handle this? What I also really liked that Kathy did was she said to her child, your friends are going to ask you about this. And there is so much research out there showing the effectiveness of peer-to-peer education, especially about sexuality. At Answer, we have a wonderful initiative called Sex Etc., and it is a magazine and a website, sexetc.org, that's written by teens for teens. So, of course, there are adults making sure that the information is factually accurate and age and developmentally appropriate, but we find that it is so effective. Young people want to hear from each other. We just want to make sure that the information they're hearing is accurate.
Kathy, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. Let's go next to Waupun, where Jamie is waiting to talk to us. Jamie, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, hell, thanks. I'm a father of a 13-year-old son, and I was disappointed to learn that he wasn't really taught much in school beyond the reproductive process. All of my conversations that I've had with him are basically based around the consequences of becoming a father before college and the duty that that comes with it. My comment and question would have to be around how India teaches the Kama Sutra and how you're supposed to actually pleasure your partner. It seems nowadays that sex is more seen as a conquest and not of, you know, the interest of the partner. And my question is, should that be taught in school? Because I feel it should be.
All right, Jamie, thank you so much. Elizabeth, we'll go to you first, and then David.
Of course you're going to go to me first with that one. Jamie, that's such a great, great question. I have to say, this is such, no pun, a hot topic right now. And, you know, when you say India teaches the Kama Sutra, it depends. The sex ed in India is not the best, I have to be honest, in terms of school-based. But what we're talking about is this idea of teaching pleasure. And, boy, people are all along the spectrum on this. I think, you know, from the very bare minimum, we have to look at what are people teaching about sexuality. And what I would say is far too often sexuality education is taught the way that you said. It's all about consequences. It's all about negativity. It's fear-based. It's shame-based. Even young people, you know, young women who do become pregnant as teens, some of them step up and do an absolutely amazing job and so shouldn't be shamed because of that, because of their status. So I think that before we get into, and I don't want to say just before, there is so much foundational knowledge and information and skills that have to be presented, but the manner in which that we could integrate lessons relating to pleasure should be just part of that, which means, for example, if a person is in a sexual relationship, sex should not hurt. If it hurts, then that's something you should stop and you should talk with your partner about. This is very different from teaching techniques or how to have sex, how to pleasure a partner, because at younger ages, I wouldn't recommend teaching about that. That is something if a parent chooses to talk with their, you know, their teenager about it, that's their choice. But in terms of school-based sexuality education, when we're looking at the positive aspects, we want to look at things like positive self-image, positive self-esteem, positive body image. We do have research that shows the worse a young person or an adult feels about him or herself, the less healthy, the less positive decisions they make about sexuality. So I do agree we have to do something about the positive aspects of sexuality and sexual behaviors. How we do it, the jury is still out.
Mm-hmm. David?
I think the question raises, you know, the broader question of, like, what is sex for? Why were we given this gift that sometimes becomes a curse because we mishandle it? And there are good theological answers to this. One of them in my tradition would be to say sex is one of the main ways we have for expressing love for another person. And then part of that would be not hurting them and making and pleasing them. And sex is also the way that we bring new life into the world and the responsibilities that go with that. And, the theological traditions do bring rich resources to bear on those questions, but often have been taught primarily no, shame-based, and here's why you can't do it, such that, I mean, a major issue for so many young Christian kids is they've been taught no and shame for so long that they can't turn that around real quickly when they do get married.
Yep.
So there are issues there related to the goodness of sexuality that we can work together on communicating in the proper context.
You know, human beings, as far as I know, have been having sex for thousands of years, millennia. And I just wonder why we haven't gotten to the point where we're a little more comfortable with it. This is still just this big mystery. And we heard earlier about the giggling junior high kids. There's some of that giggling is probably fear. But, you know, why is this such an uncomfortable topic for us to have a conversation about? I mean, all mammals have sex. That's how other mammals get here. And for heaven's sakes, why should this still be such a big deal in 2013 that it's so difficult for us to have this conversation? What is it about it that makes it so hard? David, we'll go to you first on this one.
Partly some messed up cultural attitudes. We both glorify and titillate ourselves with sex, but we also don't deal with it very frankly. And so it becomes an arena that is simultaneously mysterious and appealing and repelling. And in other words, I think we've got some cultural problems here. But I also think it deals with the mystery of that level of intimacy, that level of nakedness, that level of vulnerability. It goes to something very core in us. And maybe we just have difficulty with anything that is that raw and that vulnerable. And maybe mm-hmm. It has always been that way. I don't know.
Elizabeth, I'm probably going to end up giving you the last word here because we're starting to run out of time, but go ahead.
You bet. Well, I think this goes back to my point about extremes. We are so extreme as a culture about how we address sexuality. It is such a huge irony to me that young people can access porn so easily on the internet, yet it's still a challenge to get into a school and teach age and developmentally appropriate, medically accurate sexuality education. So we are having this sort of extreme approach. It has issues of control, so there is this sort of history of puritanical values, and we're going to be so pure and we're not going to talk about sexuality. So they can legislate that within a school setting and fight it as much as they want. But sex and sexuality and sexualized images are everywhere. Young people are getting a lot of misinformation. They're getting a lot of conflicting information. They have a lot of abstinence only until marriage programs that will say sex is dirty. Save it for someone you love. So it's really tough to educate young people in a culture where within music, on videos, all over the internet, they're seeing a lot of sexualized images, and they have absolutely no context for it. If we as adults don't keep stepping up and talking about these issues, we're going to start seeing those numbers, those wonderful statistics from California and around the country changing. We cannot sit and rest on our laurels. This should be a call to action for all of us as adults, as parents, as professionals, to step up and really make sure young people are getting the information and the skills they need.
Elizabeth Schroeder, thank you so much for joining us today. David Gushy, also to you, thank you so much. What a great hour. We could have gone on for a long time, but we are up against the clock here, so we have to close it off. I appreciate you both being here today.
Thanks very much, John.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Schroeder is Executive Director of ANSWER and an internationally recognized expert in the field of sexuality education and youth development. David Gushy is Distinguished University Professor of Christian Ethics and Director of the Center for Theology and Public Life at Mercer University. This program was produced by K.P. Whaley and Rhonda Fanning. We also had production help today from Jessica Sharpie. I'm John Munson. You're listening to the Kathleen Dunn Program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.